A long and interesting road led Chef Eddie Huang to open the popular East Village restaurant Bauhaus. A boisterous upbringing with abusive parents in Orlando, Florida, run-ins with racist classmates, trouble with the law, then work as a lawyer and stand-up comic. He's co-hosted episodes of Anthony Bourdain's The Layover and now has his own series for Vice TV, and he's written a memoir called Fresh Off the Boat. It's published by Spiegel & Grau, and I'm very pleased to welcome Eddie Huang to our show today. Hello.
What's up? How's it going?
It's okay. I guess we should point out you're also a lover of rap, so.
Yeah, definitely, most definitely.
So do you think that the rhythm of the music that you like affects the way you move in a kitchen?
Probably. Yeah, I guess it does, but it's more subconscious, you know, like it's probably affected and permeated my life. So it's not that I, you know, reserve the music for certain aspects of my life, but, you know, that's all I really know. Besides like Solid Gold Oldies, my dad sings for karaoke. Like that's my entire understanding of music is pretty much hip hop.
But it doesn't affect the food that you cook.
I don't think so. I think the food is pretty good regardless of what music I'm listening to. You know, when I cook it.
Although, when I go into a restaurant, if I hate the music, that does affect, you know, they're playing something in the background. It affects my enjoyment of the meal.
No, definitely. Most definitely. And that's the thing is that we specifically targeted an audience that we wanted to come and enjoy Bauhaus, you know, and we knew who the people we wanted to come were. And we play music that at times may be very unsavory to other types of people, you know?
It's interesting you use the word savory when you're talking about food. Now, Bauhaus, of course, is a pun. Yeah. The Bao, in this case, B-A-O, refers to pork buns, which have been favorites in Chinatown ever since I can remember, but have only recently kind of spread out into the general public, kind of like soup dumplings did a few years back when Shanghai food became popular. What do you think it is about the pork buns that has suddenly made them so popular?
Well, the thing is that these pork buns are a derivative from Taiwan, and these pork buns have been popularized in Taiwan since the 50s or 60s. And the ones that you usually get in Chinatown, they're enclosed baos, and they're more Cantonese style. And you put cha siu pork inside, and they're delicious. I grew up eating those as well.
It's called cha siu bao.
Yeah, cha siu bao. And then the thing is that I sell gua bao, and the gua bao is more shaped like a taco, I'd say, and you fill it with braised pork. We also put Taiwanese style street food chicken into it, fried chicken. We'll put tofu, but the pork bun is something that has been in Taiwan for quite a long time.
So your restaurant specializes in Taiwanese street food. What distinguishes Taiwanese cooking from Cantonese food or the foods of other parts of China?
Well, I'd say that Cantonese food, like Cantonese are probably the masters of seafood amongst, you know, the Chinese provinces, you know, and Cantonese food, they do the best job with seafood. If you're going to get sea cucumber, I'd go to a Shanghainese or a Cantonese restaurant, lobster, crab, things like that. They do a very, very good job, especially like the giant steamed oysters that you get at a Cantonese restaurant, Dungeness crab as well. Shanghainese food has a little sweeter profile, a lot of braised meats, and it's a very like silky sauce. I like that. Taiwanese food now, on the other hand, employs a lot of cured items and a lot of fermented items. There's a lot of funk to it.
Now, why is that? All of the places that we're talking about have large coastlines, and that's the reason that seafood is so big. Why do you think Taiwan moved in that direction?
Taiwan, I would say, actually, you know, there's very good seafood in Kinding, in the southern point of Taiwan. You know, there's good seafood. We're very famous for oyster pancakes, right? But Taiwan, I'd say even in the late 80s, early 90s, was a developing country. You know, Hong Kong was obviously much more developed. The fishing was much more, a lot more fishing going on there. Taiwanese food is actually very interesting. I think bamboo, stinky tofu, and a lot of pork, a lot of offal is used in Taiwanese food.
Now, you call Taiwan pound for pound the greatest eating island in the world. More than Manhattan Island?
Hands down. I think anyone that has gone to Taipei, I mean, I'm obviously biased. You know, I'm obviously biased and I put on for where my parents are from. But, you know, Taiwan has so much diversity because it was colonized by the Japanese. Then you have Chiang Kai-shek that came over with the nationalists. You have the aboriginals. You have the Hakka people. A lot of people from Fujian have come over as well. And it's really a truly diverse culinary canon that is in Taiwan.
Hadn't your family been fairly successful in Taiwan? Why did they come to the United States?
Well, my grandfather on my mother's side was very successful. And there was like, it was a communist scare. You know, a communist scare was all over the world. And they thought that Taiwan would be next. And there's always, even now, there's always that, you know, kind of tension with China.
Well, China still claims Taiwan as a part of China.
And, yes.
It objects when Taiwan acts like an independent country.
Yeah. China's definitely big brother still, and that's a sticky topic and something that I think is very difficult because Taiwan, because of the size of the country, no matter what, I feel like Taiwan will be stuck with a master.
So why did they wind up in Orlando, Florida?
It's a long journey and it's in the book, but my father came to America after he served in the Taiwanese army and he went to college at the University of Maryland. My mother came for high school when she was 17 and then she also went to the University of Maryland, College Park. And then, you know, serendipitously, they met at a house party and I popped out.
Yeah, but you could have grown up in Washington where there's a larger Chinese community. You could have grown up in New York and San Francisco and Chicago, Boston, yeah. All having larger Chinese communities. You went up in Orlando, Florida.
Yeah, well, my dad ended up going to Orlando after his furniture business closed and failed in Northern Virginia. He went to Orlando. There was a boom going on. And Orlando in those days, in the early 90s, much like Phoenix, much like Las Vegas, it was a boom town, you know? So people were kind of, you know, chasing the mouse, so to speak.
But it meant that you grew up in a community where there weren't too many other Chinese people and probably nobody else from Taiwan.
Yeah. You know, they would have get-togethers and potlucks and things like that. And, you know, I would say within 2 or 3 miles, there was one family, the Kangs, that lived down the street from us. And then I think the Lius lived about a mile and a half away from us. But those were the only three families in the neighborhood. And we went to different schools until high school. We would all go to University of Central Florida on Sundays for Chinese school. And there would be other Chinese students as well. But yeah, not that many Taiwanese. And they would drive upwards of 2 to 3 hours to come be in a community and teach kids Chinese on Sundays.
Well, you were an outsider as a Chinese kid, a rare Chinese kid in your high school. But yeah. Even in the Chinese school, Taiwanese Chinese has a very different accent, doesn't it? Did those kids look upon you as being an outsider?
Well, I was an outsider anywhere I went because I really didn't fit in. I didn't fit in Chinese school and I didn't fit in private schools. I went to 7 schools in 5 years and I didn't fit in public school either. But in the end, I kind of ended up fitting in by not fitting in.
So why do you think you were such a troubled kid?
Man, there's so many reasons for it. I think definitely race has a lot to do with it and being different and being told you're different constantly. I think that seeing one world inside the home because my parents, a lot of people like to call me second generation and I guess technically I'm second generation. But the thing is that, you know, my mom had me 3 years after she came to America. So I grew up with my mom as she was having the immigrant first generation experience in America. So same with my father, you know. So we all kind of were figuring out America at the same time, and it was definitely frustrating for my parents. They definitely lashed out at each other at home, lashed out at us.
There was physical abuse.
Yeah, and one thing is I don't want to harp on it being physical because that's just how our culture deals with it. I don't also want to speak for all Chinese or Taiwanese people saying everybody beats their children, but at least in my family, I know my cousins were hit as well. I know a lot of other kids in Chinese school were hit. This is how they do, you know?
Well, in one incident you write about, you describe trying to talk the police and child protective officers out of intervening in your home. So
I did.
You were enabling your parents, which is not unusual in abusive behavior.
I was. And, you know, it got bad that even, you know, 6th period every Friday in school, they'd take me out to talk to a counselor. And I think at a young age, that always made me feel deviant. Or made me feel like an outsider because I constantly was talking to child services. I also think that a big part is when you're hit at home and you go to school and you're already beaten and you're already kind of on edge from things like that. So any little thing somebody does or says is going to set you off.
My guess is Eddie Huang, H-U-A-N-G, his memoir, Fresh Off the Boat. A lot of kids, when they come here, the second generation, assimilate by eating American food, not the food of their parents. It's almost a form of rebellion. You have not done that.
No. Food was the thing I hung on to. I'd always see other kids bring like Filet-O-Fish or McRibs to Chinese school. As much as I love the McRib because it's just such a monstrosity, I really hung on to the food that I grew up with, and I loved it and I identified with it.
And you write about your first experience with tuna salad and macaroni and cheese while you were at a friend's house.
Yeah, no, it was definitely weird to...
Mac and cheese was not comfort food for you.
No, it wasn't at all. I didn't experience it till fourth grade. The first time I ate macaroni and cheese was in fourth grade. Same dinner I had tuna fish sandwiches at.
And what was so disgusting about them for you?
They're just foreign. And anything that's foreign, just I hope people understand that a lot of times in the book I talk about whiteness. I'm not talking about white people. And I think it's a concept that people need to understand is that there are things that are so easy for you, like macaroni, cheese, and tuna fish, that are so foreign to me. It just depends what you grew up and were raised on. Sea cucumber for me is easier than pickles.
So it cuts both ways.
Yes.
And don't some Chinese restaurants still offer different menus to their Chinese and non-Chinese customers?
I don't experience it, but at least even a writer in Seattle has told me that she just experienced it at a Korean restaurant. And the thing that I would say is that, you know, it's not that they think you don't get it or they think that you're stupid or you're not good enough for it or they want to hide it from you. It's that they've had years and years of conditioning where people have told them that food is disgusting. Mm-hmm. You know, people have ordered it and not meant to order it and they say that's disgusting.
Well, I've ordered things where a waiter has said, you won't like it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew I was going to like it because I'd already eaten it. But that's a whole other matter.
Yeah.
You have to convince people that you actually are open to things.
That you're down, in a way.
Now, you had a number of encounters with racism in high school. Do you think that it would have been different if you had grown up in San Francisco or New York or some other city that had a large Chinese community?
Absolutely. I think that I would have less of a rebellious spirit. I think that I would probably be okay with being silent more of the time. I really, because of all the things happening to me and seeing how the dangers of being silent and not speaking up, I've made it a real duty of mine to speak up for people, even if it doesn't influence me. If I see something that I feel is unjust or biased, I will speak up for those people.
You're outspoken in a lot of ways. You've gotten yourself into some trouble by expressing your opinion about some of the other chefs around,
yes,
things like
absolutely,
that.
Yes, absolutely, yes. And I would also say I don't consider it trouble. I know that it's coming. I say it in knowing what will happen.
You seem to spend a lot of time in your childhood acting out, even though you scored high in IQ tests. You weren't doing great in school.
Mm-hmm.
And then you describe selling drugs, taking drugs, arrests, fist fights. When did you turn things around?
Well, I really think that when I was on felony probation in college, it really woke me up. You know, a lot of the things that kids went through in college, I had already been going through in middle school and high school. And I kind of ran out of luck in college. You know, sometimes you run out of luck and you're forced to face yourself. And that's the most, I think, important thing as an adolescent or coming of age is to be forced to face yourself and to stare yourself. And those professors at Rollins College definitely had a huge part in me turning it around because they saw potential in me. And they were the first people to really say, you know what, like, I want to hear what you have to say. And once they said, I want to hear what you have to say, I didn't fight so hard to cause trouble. Because I used to have to cause trouble for the opportunity. I had to create my own opportunity.
Your father opened a number of successful restaurants in Orlando, but you almost did everything else. You tried your hand at sports journalism. You went to law school. You have tried being a stand-up comic. Were you trying to avoid going to the family business?
No, most definitely, because I was a big Ralph Waldo Emerson fan, reading American Scholar and, you know, saying, you know, this generation has to write its own books. And I didn't want to just follow my dad and do what he did. And even though I could have survived and made money, I wanted to create my own American story.
And what kind of restaurants did your father have?
He owned steakhouses and seafood restaurants. And he was more into making American food because he knew it would make money and he saw how he could do it. I was very, very intent on showing the world the things that my mom made at home that were special to me.
And you're right that you like getting a bowl of food that doesn't have an agenda. What do you mean by that?
It is what it is. And you know, my food does have an agenda. I will never deny that my food has an agenda culturally. But on the plate, my food doesn't have much of an agenda. It's not really thinking about how another chef will perceive it or how it's, you know, fitting into the current food culture or trends. I don't think about that.
But the agenda is to present Taiwanese food to a public that has very little knowledge of it.
Yes, and telling a very personal story and making a statement about soft power.
And you've created a fairly unconventional model to success in the food world. Did your parents want you to go into the restaurant business?
No, they did not. They even up, you know, when I first opened the restaurant for about 6 months, they didn't talk to me. They really didn't talk to me. And even when I was in the New York Times, Lagai Mishin wrote a great review. They really brushed it aside, like, it's no big deal, it's just New York.
You've called your memoir Fresh Off the Boat. FOB is actually a phrase that you hear a lot in the Chinese community, mm-hmm. even though you were born here.
Yes.
The book is published by Spiegel and Grau. Eddie Huang will be speaking with Tom Colicchio, a pretty good chef in his own right, signing books tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. Then on Wednesday at 7, he'll be at McNally Jackson at 52 Prince Street. On Thursday at 7:30, he'll be speaking with Sam Sifton in the Greenlight Bookstore. And you can also see him tonight at our own green space. Oh, I'm sorry, Thursday?
Thursday.
Our own green space for a sound check live broadcast. That's at 2 o'clock. For tickets, go to our website at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.